is nothing like I thought it would.
Welcome to Strange Angels, KBH Global Radio's continuing conversation on art, science, and contemporary culture. This is your host, Glenn Zuckman, coming to you from the KBH studios at Long Beach State University. Today on Strange Angels, a conversation with Francis Crick and Christoph Koch.
You go back 50 years, that takes you to 1951. Nobody would have any idea that you could have sequenced the human gene, and they wouldn't even know what it meant. And nor did they know that in those days they thought that computers would be used by a handful of people, you see. And those are the two major changes, totally affected science on the biology, on the medicine on the one hand, and the way we live on the other. It's just impossible to see that distance ahead.
So people made in the 60s, some people made the argument, well, DNA couldn't possibly be it because, you know, just because in thermal energy, there's a certain chance of making incorrect base pair bonding. And so if you have more than, I don't know, 200 segments or 1,000 base pairs, you're going to get errors. And clearly, you couldn't replicate information stable of thousands of generation. Every 1,000 base pair, you make an error. So clearly, this is a sensible argument why it can't be these one-dimensional strings. Well, what they missed the fact that, of course, evolution came up with, it turns out, at least 100 different proteins that do nothing but correct the errors, and some even correct the errors in the error correcting themselves. I mean, sort of very complicated machineries. They have very specific machines, very specific jobs, and the belief is that this will also be true of consciousness.
We first of all train them to get used to the mirror, because of course if they see the mirror, they think it's another animal.
Which most animals don't care. Certainly cats and dogs don't care at all about mirrors.
Well, that's not true. They just habituate rather quickly.
No, I mean, I've tried it many times. Dogs have no, I mean, partly because there's no smell associated with it. Dogs have absolutely no recognition.
Well, I've seen a young cat being...
Okay, a cat
like
maybe.
With a mirror, and then doing like this, it was another cat. You know how cats
In front
go.
Of the mirror?
Yes, and then it got sort of puzzled. And then it walked round to the back, and then it got bored.
It walked round to the back?
Yes. Well, it worked. It explored and went in the closer, and then went round. And okay. You see. So it presumably depends.
And so you get a
your pup dogs are not very smart. That's
no. That's no. They know it's not a. They know it's just an image.
Today on Strange Angels. The Quest for Consciousness, a conversation with neurobiologist Francis Crick of the Salk Institute and neurobiologist Christoph Koch from Caltech. Back in 2001, 2 years before the advent of Strange Angels, I was thinking about a new series of portrait paintings, and with that in mind, I photographed then Adobe Systems CEO John Warnock, educator Aaron Gruel, and neurobiologists Francis Crick and Christoph Koch. For this new series, I also recorded interviews. Although I had no idea at the time, this series was in some sense the progenitor of Strange Angels. The night before I flew up to San Jose to meet with John Warnock, literally the night before, I trekked out to the Sony outlet store in Lake Elsinore and bought the first of much audio equipment. These first interviews had various technical difficulties. The Crick and Koch interview was almost unlistenable because of periodic high-frequency RF interference. Recently, audio engineer Richard Cooper performed a fantastic piece of surgery on the recording and eliminated the bulk of the interference. You'll still have to put up with some jet noise, but hopefully Francis and Christoph's ideas are worth it. On Tuesday, 13 March 2001, I made my way down to the La Jolla Hilltop home of Francis and Odile Crick. Francis, Odile, Christoph, and I had lunch at the side of their backyard pool, hence all the jet noise, and after lunch we recorded this conversation. Early in the conversation, you'll hear Christoph ask if this is cream, referring to an after-lunch beverage with a kick, after which you'll hear me say, it's okay to clink, meaning that it's okay to eat some fresh fruit while we talk. Even now, 3.5 years later, I still remember, still recall the conscious percept, that this was the freshest fruit I'd ever tasted. I began our conversation with the question, what is consciousness?
I guess the first question would be, what is consciousness?
Do we have a definition? I've forgotten.
No, not really.
Do we have a definition of being unconscious? Well, you're unconscious when you're in a deep sleep or under a deep anesthetic. But what about zombie states?
Well, you're presumably not conscious of those. So the path of consciousness, I think that's easier to talk about. It's the fact that we have subjective feelings, and at the moment it's unclear how a physical system like a brain brain under certain conditions, well slept, well, you know, awakened and a healthy brain. Brain should have these states that it feels color, it feels pain. It's like something to be me. It's very puzzling.
I think one should say that, first of all, it's a mistake to try and give a precise definition of something when you're just exploring it. On the other hand, you have to have a general idea of what it is. And we've progressed from looking at the general idea in more detail, haven't we? I mean, we've asked ourselves, well, you know, there are things they call qualia, like the blueness of blue or the painfulness of pain. And does a dog have qualia, you see? Is it appropriate to talk in that sort of sense? So what are the things that are mysterious? Is it? And then we've asked ourselves about different states where people are not fully conscious. So consciousness is a sort of portmanteau. It's going to cover a lot of things, and eventually I don't think we'll use it when we understand it. You see?
Really?
Yes. Well, we just use it in the general sense, but
well, we use it like memory, right?
Yes. You, and the same is true of things like the concept of a gene. It's very difficult to define it. You just use this as a general sort of way, and then you talk about the particular one aspect you're concerned with, you see? So that's the way we're going. But remember, haven't got an answer yet. So in the case of a gene, we have got an answer.
And do you think approaching consciousness from big top-down questions like qualia is going to be fruitful, or?
Well, those are the questions. The question is, well, what you want to know is what sort of the answer is going to be and what level. And basically, we think you have to go down to all levels. I think you can stop at atoms.
Well, we can probably stop at molecules, at proteins, at ionic channels.
Yes. Well, ions. Yes, ions are near enough atoms, aren't they? But the point is, you don't have to ask about the internal structure of the nucleus of an atom.
Or probably even not of a protein.
Well,
no, I mean, the idea is we start off with high-level quests, you know, what is qualia and all of that, but ultimately it has to boil down to mechanisms. Where in the brain, what sort of neurons, and under what condition, what time scale is feedback involved? Are there particular neurons involved? Are there particular molecules involved? Maybe this only happens when a certain neurotransmitter act release. And so rather than use these highfalutin words, the idea is to try to get it down to something very concrete that you can test in humans or in an animal model like a monkey or a mouse.
But on the other hand, you have to think in more general terms, and you have to use words. But they should be regarded as...
provisional.
Yes, that's right, provisional. It's trying to get you closer to the problem. And ultimately, maybe we can give an answer in general terms and just illustrate it by the mechanisms. But we're a long way off doing that yet.
Which seems to lead right to my next question, which is, what is the NCC?
Well, we don't know is the answer, isn't it?
Okay, but there one can give sort of a working definition. The NCC would be sort of the minimal, it's a sort of a construct, it's the minimal neuronal mechanism that are necessary for a particular conscious percept, like the color blue or pain or, you know, red, anything. So we know the entire brain is sufficient if you're a normal, healthy brain. It's probably a very small subcomponent of the brain. Where are the critical neurons that are really necessary to give rise to consciousness? Which ones are the ones, the minimal set of neurons that are necessary to give rise to a specific percept? So for different percepts, they're likely to be different NCCs. And one question is there a common element? Do they all look the same? Are they all in the same part of the brain?
But you are assuming that it's one part, where it can be the interaction with that part, with other parts as well.
As of March 13, 2001, what do we know about the NCC?
Well,
we know it's probably cortical.
Yes.
We know, we think it has to be involved some sort of neural activity that has to last for a sufficient long time, let's say on the order of a fraction of a second. It probably has to go above a threshold.
But what it is exactly, whether it's some special form of firing and... We've got a number of hypotheses, but the answers we don't know. Those are plausible ways of approaching the problem.
I mean, I guess two extreme views is one is that many people take is that consciousness sort of can never be assigned to individual groups or even small population of neurons. The claim is it's a gestalt property of, you know, 10 billion, 20 billion neurons firing. Our position would be a bit more towards the other. We say, well, there might be very well identifiable discrete mechanisms or network interactions that are responsible for it. In the former case, if the former case is true, it's going to be almost impossible, at least for any foreseeable time, to uncover it. It's really true that, you know, in order to be conscious, you need 20 billion neurons firing in a certain way. then you know we don't have a chance to understand it, at least, you know, on any foreseeable time scale. And we tend to believe the latter, in other words, that there's specific mechanisms or specific network interactions, because the character of biology seems to be of that nature. If you look at molecular biology, cell biology, anywhere else in evolution, they're all little gadgets. These little gadgets that are highly sophisticated that you would never expect on sort of a priori grounds. And so consciousness probably is another one of these gadgets that that evolution came up with.
Or a set of gadgets. Yeah.
But were you telling me that there are, 100 different proteins that are responsible for mediating...
For preparing DNA.
To prepare to copy it.
That's just a guess from looking at the genes.
But these are proteins that are involved in helping to do the accurate high fidelity...
In correcting errors.
So people made in the 60s, some people made the argument, well, DNA couldn't possibly be it. Why? Well, because, you know, just because on thermal energy, that there's a certain chance of making incorrect base pair bonding. And so if you have more than, I don't know, 200 segments or 1,000 base pairs, you're going to get errors. And clearly, you couldn't replicate information stable of thousands of generation. Every 1,000 base pair, you make an error. So clearly, this is a sensible argument why it can't be these one-dimensional strings. Well, what they missed the fact that, of course, evolution came up with, it turns out, at least 100 different proteins that do nothing but correct the errors, and some even correct the errors in the error correcting themselves. I mean, sort of very complicated machineries. And so, again, all these molecules aren't just random. They aren't sort of colloidal swimming around. They are very specific machines, very specific jobs. And the belief is that this will also be true of consciousness.
Well, the belief is that the brain is involved, a lot of neurons of a very special sort with gadgets interacting.
And I believe that the character of NCC will be of a similar nature. This might be wrong, but that's at least the strong hunch.
There's always a chance there may be some simple defining characteristic, but it's more likely it'll be a series of things. You have to have this and this.
This is cream, right?
Yeah.
Especially for you.
It does taste more punch.
Are you recording?
Yes, but... We can clank.
You can serve some sake.
Yeah, well, what about the spoons?
We don't have any, you've got the spoons and things there.
Yes,
okay.
Spoons, yeah.
How does a consciousness researcher spend his or her days?
Reading other people's papers, it seems to me, is most of what we spend our time doing. And then having discussions about possible ways of thinking about it, but I'm not sure how the division of time goes. Of course, what we like to do is to think of experiments which will bear on our ideas, and I personally don't do experiments. Christoph does some experiments, and other experiments we hope to get some of our friends to do. So that's what we should be doing.
I mean, well, right now it's a question of synthesizing. You know, the brain sciences is hugely growing. You know, the annual meeting of Society of Neuroscience is now 15,000 talks. And each year there's a new set of 15,000 talks. So, probably it's just a job of trying to synthesize it. And the more we discover,
fortunately, a lot of the talks are probably irrelevant, but there are enough...
Well, but it's difficult to know ahead of time, of course, exactly which
that's
are.
That's the problem, yes.
There's plenty of people doing research, and in a sense, you're doing a more modeling...
No, there are a lot of people doing research, but until recently, were very few doing anything which
relevant,
which bore directly on consciousness.
Until 5 years ago,
it bore on lots of other things, like the mechanism for memory or something like that, which is something we have to consider for consciousness. But they weren't focused on consciousness as such.
So 10 years ago, almost everybody worked on anesthetized animals. Probably not going to tell you all that much about consciousness, right? If the animals are anesthetized, obviously.
No.
You get quite a lot of activity in visual cortex in an animal that's lightly anesthetized. So that shows you straight away that not all the activity in your brain leads to consciousness.
What's the thing that you don't know that you would most like to know?
How important the timing of the spikes is. Would you say that?
Temple coding, yes. You mean temple coding?
Yeah.
Well, it's one of the things, because I would like to know what the NCC is, and whether it follows the properties of consciousness become apparent. It's not clear. Our hope is that once we understand, I think once science will run its course, there's no doubt that we will know whenever you, Glenn Zuckman, are conscious of this color you're painting, these neurons in the brain fire in this particular way involving these other neurons, okay? And we can tell you what happens if you get disease, what happens if you get drunk, what happens if you get Parkinson, all those things. We will be able to see once science runs this course how that will affect.
I may not still be painting at that time, but
okay, yes, it might take a long time. But what still might escape us, why activity of this sort in these neurons gives rise to this buzz? So that can we go beyond near correlations? That remains unclear. Of course, philosophers are totally divided on this.
There is a philosophical problem. I mean, it's a real scientific problem, but it has a philosophical flavor. I'm seeing things, all right? Here's this activity going on in my brain. Well, I'm not aware of neurons firing. I'm aware of this. That's a very profound problem, you see. You say, well, somewhere in the brain there's something that fires when I see a spoon. Okay? But how does my brain know that's a spoon? I mean, I know, because you know. But how does my brain know that it's a spoon? And this problem hasn't been properly addressed yet.
All right. It's
what the philosophers called intentionality, or about this is the proper, there's a lay term for it.
And I guess not just with respect to consciousness, but perhaps in your terms of your life and career and the bigger picture, what's it all about for you?
What was the... why do we work on consciousness? Is that the question?
Not quite.
The meaning of life?
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what's your mission?
Well, when I was... after the war working in the Admiralty, I decided there were two areas I was interested in which appeared to be very mysterious. One was the borderline between the living and the non-living, what we now call molecular biology. Because people at that time said you couldn't explain a living thing in terms of dead molecules. Sounds a good argument. And the other one was how the brain worked, and in particular consciousness, you see. So I started off studying the first problem, and that surprisingly, you know, the answers came out so that it's no longer a problem. You don't really have people now who are vitalists as far as E. coli is concerned or simple organisms. But we still don't know whether we can explain the consciousness in scientific terms or not. So that's my motivation.
You're listening to Strange Angels on KBeach Global Radio in Long Beach at 1310 AM, across the globe at www.kbeach.org. This is your host, Glenn Zuckman. It's The Quest for Consciousness today as we listen to my March 2001 conversation with neurobiologists Francis Crick and Christoph Koch.
We have EEGs and MRIs and all these different techniques that are limited by temporal resolution or spatial resolution or signal to noise. Is that going to get better, and what's the state of brain research today?
Well, it's going to get better, but how fast it's going to get better is not so clear. I mean, for example, the molecular biology techniques are going to be very useful. But I'm sure there'll be more brain activity techniques, don't you think?
But what we're lacking for the foreseeable future is sort of something what people call mesoscopic scale, between recording, we can record, you know, one or two neurons or maybe 50 neurons, and we can record using EEG and MRI the activity of probably millions of neurons, literally, you know, half a million, million, several million neurons. But what we need to do, we need to be able to identify, let's say, 1,000 neurons it's in various parts of the brain and record those. And not only record them, then we need to analyze them and display them, and that's something very difficult. Our brain isn't made to, you know, we don't have the techniques, B, we don't have a way to think about them, right? Our brains are not made to think about 1,000 variables independently of each other, except in some sort of average sense, like people in thermodynamics study gases, but, you know, the brain's not like a gas. So we really need to sort of develop new tools and new techniques, new mathematical and conceptual techniques.
Actually, when I spoke with Bruce Murray, he talked about wanting images of Mars or wherever you're looking at to be no more than sort of four times the previous image, because if you look, everybody thinks you want a really close view, but if you just have this super close view without the contextualizing other images, it's useless. You don't know if it's Mars or the Mojave Desert.
So you need both, and we don't really have tools at the intermediate level.
Do you have a vision of what new tools would...
Well, new tools, it's difficult to... we can think of possible tools, but the real point is that the tools that have turned up in the last 30 years are things people didn't foresee. It's very difficult to foresee either new tools or new types of science beyond about 5 or 10 years.
MRI really came on the scene. Functional MRI is 10 years old, and it's made dramatic difference. It led to the birth of a new science, cognitive neuroscience. And that, 20 years ago, you might have foreseen it if you were very smart, but 40 years ago, it just wasn't on anybody's horizon.
Who was it that said making predictions is really difficult, especially when it's about the future?
That's right.
So will we be able to reverse engineer the human brain at some point?
Well, I think not necessarily in detail, but you'd have to... It's like asking whether you can understand the weather. You understand some of the details, you understand the broad pictures, and as time goes on, you get a better understanding. It'll be something like that.
And do we need to reverse engineer it, or is understanding the human genome or some other thing that ultimately gives rise to a brain?
Oh, no. You can't do it just from the genes. There's too much in the way things interact, the way the things develop, and what you learn from experience.
It depends what you want.
It would be interesting to know what is laid down by the genes, but the point is that there are simple organisms like a nematode, which is probably all laid down by its genes. But even when you get to a fruit fly, that's not the case.
If you had to guess, do you think an ant is conscious?
Well, so if you mean, no. If you mean sort of ability to do planning and to have to have a large enough behavioral repertoire, so you don't need these automatic systems, no, I would say no.
I would guess not. Yes,
you know, mammals probably are.
Really, I wouldn't put much money on my guess.
Oh really? So it's just too hard to.
Well, at the moment, I think that's something we might be close to answering to in 5 or 10 years' time or something. That sort of thing. Even if we didn't understand the mechanisms.
Yeah, because one can think of tests. We're thinking of zombie tests, etc., which you could apply to animals. But, my guess would be most mammals, certainly rodents and dogs and monkeys and certainly apes.
And would you imagine consciousness to be a continuum, that it's not there's not a line somewhere, but it's...
I think there may be a line, but definitely will be simpler in simpler animals, yes.
Well, even you, it varies, right? If you get up, you have a hangover, you haven't slept a lot, if you go back in time when you're very young, infant, it's unclear if you come, if you're just born, to what extent are you really conscious? How much do you need to learn before you're conscious? So even nothing waxes and wanes on a day-to-day basis and over a lifetime. And the same thing is going to be true with animals.
But it is possible that there is some step so that you can draw lines and say...
France is looking for mutation.
No,
a single point mutation somewhere.
And then the first forms of consciousness would probably be very restricted.
And like pain and pleasure,
yes.
Probably.
Yeah, something like that, you see.
When I whack a cockroach in the kitchen and it's flailing around, is it experiencing pain?
Or? Well, one of Christoph's colleagues, Seymour Benzer, he worries whether Drosophila shows pain. He's actually trying to think how to work on it. And it obviously appears to... It reacts as if it felt pain, but it isn't clear that it does feel pain.
Well, so you can do the following experiments with locusts that you can't do in a mammal. You can do an experiment on this visual system where you cut off its visual head because you want to put an electrode in. You do something on its legs because that's where its ears are to record from it, and this must be very painful, yet the animal calmly continues to feed... To feed up front. In fact, you can cut up half the leg, and the animal on top continues to feed. So that's something mammal would never do. Your mammal would go into shock or something. If you imagine that.
No, but
to
apparently,
you.
According to Seymour, you feel sort of unkind to a Drosophila. It does sort of wince.
Actually, it's amazing. You get a sliver in your finger, and you're almost unable to function. And certainly, if you actually have a significant illness, so much of what you take for granted is. Yep. Leaves your repertoire.
But there are people you see claimed in battle who have serious wounds and they don't feel the pain till afterwards. So it's not a clear case at all about pain. You can't be sure that just because a person is showing, or an animal is showing signs of pain, you can't be, the chances are they're conscious of the pain, but you can't be certain of it when you go down to organisms which are very different from mammals or vertebrates.
What's attention?
Well, there's a famous quotation from James, but I'm not sure I can do it. And people do.
It's a taking in the possession of the mind.
Is it? You focus on some things as opposed to others, or something of that sort.
It's some process that's very ill understood that allows you to process one or a few stimuli at the expense of lots of other stimuli. Right, I can attend to you at the expense of attending to lots of other things. That means I can do certain things better now or with lower error rates. It's very unclear what it means at the neuron level.
It's conventional to say, and it may be roughly right, that there are two forms of attention. One is top-down attention. I want to attend to what he's helping himself to eat or something like that. And there's bottom-up attention, when there's a big bang over there and my attention is drawn to it. That's probably true. And we did find a case recently where one is pitted against another. Or the Cheshire Cat.
Yeah.
You know this business?
It's at the Exploratorium in San Francisco. You're looking at a mirror, you're looking at two mirrors, and in here you can put a picture of a Cheshire Cat. Mm-hmm. And over here, so it goes into one eye. And over here, let's say you put your hand. And that's your hand. You clearly see the Cheshire Cat, and then you move. And what happens, the motion attracts attention, and you tend to see the hand, you can wipe out the face. And it's claimed that you can erase...
That's the first thing, yes. That's step you erase one. The cat, temporarily.
That's relatively uncontroversial. What's being claimed then, that you can erase the face of the cat, yet you still see the smile.
If you concentrate on the mouth, it says you can wipe it away, and the mouth remains with the smile.
You know,
so
like Alice in Wonderland.
The rest of the cat disappears, you see. Well, this is a bottom-up one, and your attention is a top-down one, you see, and they're rivaling. And where you're paying attention, the top-down one wins, and where you're not, the bottom-up one wins, you see. That's the argument.
So Lewis Carroll was a neurobiologist.
psychologist.
It isn't clear, I mean...
He was a logician, actually.
It's not clear he had any... There's no evidence that he used a mirror to do that, is it? It was just a concept for him.
He was a logician, right? So maybe...
It's a very Lewis Carroll remark, but I don't think it was based on actually observing anything.
Probably not.
It's just, no.
Is there a difference between self-consciousness and awareness?
Well, that's usual to say there's a difference between consciousness and awareness, and people do make a distinction. And then there's a difference between consciousness and self-consciousness. Yes, I thought there would be a difference between consciousness and self-consciousness, yes. But self-consciousness is, again, a vague term. What do you mean by being self-conscious? And the various tests for animals and so on. But it probably refers to a number of different things you can do. But probably a lower vertebrate, if we may use such a term, is probably not very self-conscious. I don't think it's very well defined, is it?
But somehow means you have a model of yourself, right? Some sort of model of yourself you can refer to. And you can use that in tests in animals, and it's claimed that at least the higher apes, chimps, and orangutans have that, but not monkeys.
I'm sure a monkey knows that hand is his hand. Don't you think?
Yeah.
You know?
That's a good point. And so it knows, you know, the difference is that I can just see blue here, but I can also see, I know that I'm seeing blue, right? That's the difference. And the question is that, I mean, I think our belief, is it correct to say, Franz, that what is an elaboration of the other, that first you had consciousness, evolutionary, and then later on, as your prefrontal cortex became more complex, you evolved a view of yourself, and you evolved this idea of a persona and all of that, then the self became involved. Now I know I, Christoph, I'm looking at the blue. But that's probably just a refinement. That's, of course, very important for us to do planning. But it's probably just a refinement on the basic idea of consciousness. That would be my guess.
Well, I agree with General. But there are people who think that even there's something involved in the self just to be conscious at all. But I don't think that's what you mean by it. You have to tell us what you mean by being self-conscious.
Well, I mean, in a vernacular sense, it seems to me... Or in a linguistic sort of sense, it seems like language is in there somewhere, and it has a meta quality that I'm aware of myself being aware.
Well, the test they use on animals, briefly, they anesthetize the animal, put a spot in its forehead, and it's used to looking in a mirror, and if they look in the mirror and do this, they think they're self-conscious, you see. Monkeys don't do that, and most of the apes will.
I hadn't heard that. So they see the spot and just ignore it? Or...
Yeah. You first of all train them to get used to the mirror, because of course if they see the mirror, they think it's another animal.
Which most animals don't, most animals don't care. Certainly cats and dogs don't care at all about mirrors.
Well, that's not true. They just habituate rather quickly.
No, I mean, I've tried it many times. Dogs have no, partly because there's no smell associated with it. Dogs have absolutely no recognition.
Well, I've seen a young cat being...
Okay, a cat
like
maybe.
With a mirror, and then, doing like this, it was another cat. You know how cats...
In front of the mirror?
Yes, and then it got sort of puzzled, and then it walked round to the back, and then it got bored.
It walked around to the back?
Yes. Well, it explored and went the closer and then went round, and okay. You see. So it presumably depends.
And so you get a...
Your pup dogs are not very smart.
No. They know it's not a... They know it's just an image. So you get apes to be... And they apes play with the image. They do this and they do grimaces. They really play with the image. And you get them used to the fact that's how they look. And then you anesthetize them and paint something here. And then those apes that were previously exposed to the mirror, knew something was wrong. They tried to scrape it off. While those apes that were never exposed before, they didn't care. Right? For them, the first time they saw them with the white head. I'm not sure whether these experiments have ever been redone. They're widely cited. But
yes, it would time they did.
There are experiments like that, but it's very difficult to do self-conscious in animals, right? So our strategy is for now to leave it aside. We don't think it's fundamental. We don't think it's more fundamental than, olfactory consciousness or visual consciousness. Except those are much easier to study right now.
You're listening to Strange Angels, KBeach Global Radio's continuing conversation on art, science, and contemporary culture. Join us Saturdays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time for conversations with the performing artists, visual artists, literary artists, and neurobiologists who are shaping the cultural zeitgeist of this new millennium. You'll find us in Long Beach at 1310 a.m. and across the globe at www.kbeach.org. We're listening today to my 13 March 2001 conversation with Francis Crick and Christoph Koch. Bookending this conversation is Nobel laureate Francis Crick's 1994 book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul, and Christoph Koch's 2004 book, The Quest for Consciousness, A Neurobiological Approach. Francis' 1994 dedication reads, for Christoph Koch, without whose energy and enthusiasm this book would never have been written. Christoph's 2004 dedication reads, I dedicate this book to Francis Crick, friend, mentor, and scientist. Francis Crick died on Wednesday, 28 July of this year. According to Christoph, 2 hours before he passed away, Francis was still dictating a paper. In Christoph's words, he was a scientist to the last. When we return, we'll hear part two of my conversation with Francis Crick and Christoph Koch, recorded at the side of Francis and Odile Crick's backyard pool in La Jolla, California, on Tuesday, 13 March 2001.
I wondered if we could do a little time traveling, neurobiology in time, and I'll give you a few different years in the past and future, and if you could tell me what we knew then or what we might know and what sort of the model was at the time. 1900?
Gosh. Well, I can tell you, Freud, 1895, they barely knew there were synapses. The theory that neurons, discrete entities called neurons, was just about established.
Even that wasn't entirely accepted because Golgi didn't believe
it. You're right, that happened. Yeah, so it was still controversial, although the weight of the evidence was in favor of the view that discrete entity rather than this continuum. They knew almost nothing about, or they basically knew nothing about physiology, about how individual neurons work.
They didn't know that nerve impulses traveled at a finite speed and not the speed of light.
That was Helmholtz. That was in Dubois, Raymond. That was 1870.
That's what I'm saying. By 1900, they knew that.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't know the mechanism, how the thing went down. I'm not sure how much they knew about individual nerves.
Well, they knew about the brain nerves.
They called a nerve was individual axons.
I don't know. It must have been because the microscopy was there.
Yes, I think Gahl must have known that.
They barely knew that there were specific areas from the motor strip was discovered and Broca's area was discovered. That was really the beginning of modern neurology, 1870 or something, when people realized, you know, a discrete lesion. The phrenologist program, when they realized that there are discrete lesions that give rise to a discrete deficit, in this case, aphasia.
But they tended to talk about energy in the brain. There was energy for this. I noticed that what Hewlett Jackson did. I think that's what Freud did.
Freud, yeah, they used the term energy, and repression, energy repressed.
They didn't think of it in terms of information. It's all in terms of energy.
Yeah, they didn't have any good term for it. Tononi pointed this out to me. He said, certainly in Freud's writing in 1895, in his writing on aphasia, there was no notion of inhibition as a process. There was,
I believe that's right,
positive energy and then negative energy, and they somehow cancelled. Because they knew about physics and energies, but they didn't know about sort of, you know, the idea of current flow and action potential exciting other cells. That was all not known. So you can see why somebody like Freud might have been frustrated and would have given that up in favor of psychology.
1950?
Well, at the time you made a decision not to study the brain, right?
But I'm trying to think what they knew then.
Well, Hodgkin-Huxley was...
No, it wasn't.
It was just a couple of years before.
Yes, it was just... They had a beginning of idea of how signals down an axon, but they didn't know. But if you said 1954, they would have done. By 1950, there was a strong feeling that all these synapses were electrical, not chemical. Although they did know that there were, I think they knew about acetylcholine.
Now, who's the guy who was most persistently wrong? One of the more famous American neuroscientists. He was very active at Harvard, Lashley. So it was believed that the brain, this equipotentiality theory, that the brain isn't specific, that, you know, you store things and you do and vision, etc., in various parts of the brain. It's very unspecific. And your memory loss, for example, if I take away your part of the brain, the memory loss is proportional to how much brain I take away. Holographic theory was popular at the time. You know, that memory is like a holograph stored all over the brain. If you take half the brain away, your memory will degrade by half.
I don't think it was, I think holographic thing had come in by then, but I don't think it had been applied to the brain, but the general idea was there.
Yeah, you're right, holographic probably came later. And so that's radically different from today, the view that sort of goes the other extreme, that they are very, you know, specific neurons that do very specific things like, you know, color perception and, you know, angle of gaze, and that's different from having neurons that are responsible for doing the gender of faces. So it was sort of the opposite.
They hadn't put any electrodes into animals' brains. I mean, that was done in the late 50s when they began.
Well, I want to say there was Colin Blake, Mountcastle.
Yes, they did people in the middle 50s. It was...
Well, and then Hublin, when was that? 1959,
no, it was certainly wasn't in 1950. It was in the latter 50s. And before them, there was Mountcastle, and there was somebody before him.
Well, this guy in Germany, Jung, who missed B1.
Yes, well, there were people beginning to use single electrodes at that time.
So it was just sort of the beginning of the modern era.
Yes.
1950s, very different from physics. This science is very young.
1980?
What had happened by 1980? Well, let's see. I can do that because that's when I wrote my Scientific American article, roughly, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then we knew...
79.
They knew a lot about the first visual areas, and they were just beginning to realize there were more visual areas.
So at the time, everything was studied, V1 was studied, and almost nothing was known outside. They were all called association areas, and it was all a white spot on the map.
Ullmann and Cass on the one hand, and Zecchi on the other, pioneered the other areas, but it wasn't realized then how many there were. But at least that was the beginning of that.
So it was V1 and then the rest, association areas.
And also, of course, there was the sort of the beginning of the theoretical work on neural networks and the theoretical work on... Which 1980, let's see, I've forgotten. I don't think we had back prop by then.
No. Hopfield was 82 and 84.
Yes. And David Marr. But there must be other things. Oh, the chemical synapse had been thoroughly well established by then. But I can't remember when they first realized the
NMDA? That was later.
Well, there were channels that opened.
Ionic channels, yeah.
Yes.
That was beginning on there because Sackmann and Nea started the thing in 78, 79. So that's more at the molecular level.
Yes, that's right, yes. Because before that, they knew that there was some chemical effect, but they didn't know whether there was something shunting across the membrane. And when they found the amount, how fast it went, they realized it had to be opening a channel. There must have been lots of other things going on when we're only touching on some of it. They hadn't got any scans by then.
No.
I mean, not the modern ones.
So their brain scans more like 1990.
Well, that was our next stop, 1990.
Yeah, I guess what really made the big difference is the beginning of brain scans.
Well, I think there are two sorts of brain scans. Was there
functional.
Yes.
Functional were probably early, mid-80s.
There's the tomography one and the original MRI, static MRI. And then the first real activity scan was PET scanning, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Invasive.
And then
2DG. Various invasive things with radioactive elements, and then functional imaging that's totally non-invasive. So that probably made the biggest difference.
2001?
Beginning molecular biology. Beginning to see molecular biology at the systems level.
Or knockouts.
Yeah, the tools for molecular biology.
Being able to knock out things in mice and seeing how it affected behavior. That's going by now, but only just beginning.
2005?
Well, who knows?
Well, hopefully, I mean, people are spending over the last 10 years a lot of effort on doing these multi-unit recordings. So you can now do, and there's a significant number of groups that can record from 50 or 100 neurons or maybe 200 neurons. You know, we're just talking about this is really the missing link. So there are people, there are many theoreticians who are looking at this problem now, and there are lots of experimentalists, and the techniques are becoming better, they're becoming more routine. Many more groups are now using tetrodes, for instance. It's really becoming almost a standard that people are beginning to... So I think that one of the big differences is that we'll be able to record reliable for many more neurons rather than doing one neuron, which has been sort of the gold standard over the last 50 years. And then also interfering sort of the combination of using these molecular biology techniques, particularly in mice, where you can engineer animals, you know, to selectively and reversibly and transiently and delicately sort of turn off and turn on specific groups of neurons. I think that's going to be very, very promising, very exciting. So I think those two techniques, recording for many neurons and these molecular techniques. And of course, all the, you know, the functional imaging scans will get better, but I don't see, it doesn't look right now, they'll get dramatically better.
Well, we should know much more about what genes are active in neurons and things like that. See, when I think of what we've been saying, I'm sure we left out a lot of stuff. Because, you know, it's not something we normally think about. So it's more rather a random collection of...
Last stop on the neurobiology tour, 2050?
That's impossible.
Well, I'm pretty sure there are certain things one can predict with certainty. I mean, assuming there's no major catastrophe, we'll have brain implants. I mean, that we're going to see in the next 10 years. There are already some very simple ones now. It's like a cochlear transplant, okay? Routinely done, you know, there are a few hundred thousand people who run around with cochlear transplant. There are now a few people where they're doing it on humans, volunteers. They've done it in one lady at NIH, for example, where they implanted, she's blind, a chip in the occipital cortex. They took it out again after 6 weeks. So by 2050, we'll have people that have sort of retinal transplants and probably cortical transplants. And for that, we need to have advances at the material side. We need to put in chips or silicon or whatever probes that can stay there stably for tens of years, you know, without gliosis, without sort of having immune response. We need to be able to code, to both speak and understand the language of neurons in order to read out and feedback signals. That I'm pretty sure we are going to have.
Otherwise, the impossible question, you can see, you go back 50 years, that takes, or 49 years, whatever you like, takes you to 1951 or two. Nobody would have any idea that you could have sequenced the human gene, and they wouldn't even know what it meant. And nor did they know that in those days they thought that computers would be used by a handful of people, you see. And those are the two major changes, totally affected, you know, science on the biology, on the medicine on the one hand, and the way we live on the other. It's just impossible to see that distance ahead. So
I mean, just the network, the web, right? We all know that in 10 years, it's dramatically affected sociology of science. Just the exchange of information has just gone up by
everything. Yes.
Yeah, and that, I mean, yeah, even 10, 15 years ago. I mean, I remember I have an account way back from 1982 at my first email account at MIT, and in 82 there was no. I mean, you know, there was some science fiction writer, you know, Gibson, who had these ideas of cyberspace, but nobody could perceive this and how it would affect us in myriads of ways. So, you know, Clark has said any sufficient technology can't be distinguished from magic, and I think it's very difficult to foresee how these things will be. I was recently looking at Arthur C. Clarke's predictions. He overestimates physics, you know, time travel and settlement on planets, and he totally underestimates biology.
Mm-hmm. Is biology just physics?
No, because you have to add natural selection, and that makes it totally different. That's a short answer.
That's a good one. Ants in a colony, neurons in a brain, people in a culture. What's the difference?
Computers in a network. Man, we talked about that. That's a very interesting one.
Yes.
I read this book by Deborah, what's her name? She was at Caltech, and she's written about ant colonies. And I wonder, well, how do we know that the colony as a whole isn't conscious? You know, because you would never say neuron is conscious, but brain seem to be conscious. Well, but so ants... So, I mean, how could you tell? Well, can the anthill engage in any very complex behavior, organized behaviors? You know, and that it's very unclear. I mean, you know, she does these experiments where you take the anthill and cut it in two and transplant it, and it has some sort of adaptive response, but it seems fairly unsophisticated. So same thing with computer networks. That's at least so far on the web, you know, there are, I don't know, a billion computers on the web, and they're all very complicated. But in terms of collective behaviors, there is almost none. And people in a culture, you know, we just went through this NASDAQ, the hysteria about NASDAQ, or we went through Y2K. Remember Y2K? I mean, that's a very nonlinear behavior. The next day, it was all history. It was what was all the big deal about? And before we worried, the world is going to come to an end. So you have these very nonlinear behaviors with people, very complicated behaviors, very difficult to predict, but that's not the case so far with computer networks, although it'll change, and certainly not the case with atoms in a box or with ants in an anthill. So I think those, at least, are not conscious. I mean, who's to say what computers will become, but so far, I think not.
So you'd be more likely to call culture conscious than an ant colony.
Yeah, but I don't know what that means. Because at least cultures have very complicated behaviors, you know, and it's a huge behavioral repertoire. Although I'm just not sure what it would mean for... Even unclear what it would mean for a computer network to be really conscious.
Is the left hemisphere a person and the right hemisphere an automaton?
Well, there are different opinions, but I believe it isn't. The right hemisphere is a person, too. I mean, phenomenally, they talk to each other, so you can't make this thing. Only if you cut the corpus, only if you cut the connections, you can ask that question.
Yeah, I think the evidence seems to be, and I think most people who study it agree, that there are two people. One is very lingual, one is very verbal, the other one is sort of more things in picture and isn't nearly as verbal, although it's not true that the right hemisphere is totally mute. You know, usually if you ask very often it can speak very simple, sort of like yes, no, and certainly it can understand simple commands, so it's not like it's deaf mute. But it's much, you know, it has much, much less linguistic abilities than the other one. But as far as we can tell, there are two people, two entities inside this one head. And I always wonder, to what extent the echoes of discussions you have with yourself, to what extent these are distant echoes of the two hemispheres. For example, when you do sports, you know, and you've run an hour and you discuss, well, should I stop now, should I not stop? You know, and there's for somebody, you know, one entity that says, you know, let's do another mile. And the other one says, well, you've done already, you know, enough. Things like that, when you have these debates with yourself, is that an echo of the two hemispheres? I don't know. It's very difficult to test. You would expect, if it's true, that one is very verbal, mm-hmm. and the other entity is more picture-bound but not verbal. Because there is a delay between the two, and you might have more stable assemblies here and here than here, so it's not implausible that you can sometimes have these entities.
You're listening to Strange Angels on KBeach Global Radio in Long Beach at 1310 AM, across the globe at www.kbeach.org. This is your host, Gwen Zuckman. It's The Quest for Consciousness today as we listen to my March 2001 conversation with neurobiologists Francis Crick and Christoph Koch.
Did you, by any chance, ever meet Alan Turing?
Well, I did, in the sense that I went to a lecture of him on his ideas about patterns and things, but I never really met him. I mean, I spoke a couple of words with him afterwards, but no, the answer is I didn't really.
When did he die? 52, 53?
No, the late 40s, I think.
No, I thought it was later than
it
that.
It could have been.
Because his paper is like 50, I think, the one on morphogenesis.
I think you may be right. I'm trying to think when I was... Because when I met him, it was when I was at Cambridge, but then I went to Cambridge in 47, so I can't be sure about that. I really don't know. It's about that time. There's 1950 plus or minus.
If I told you that I'd created a machine of human-level intelligence and that it and a person were waiting in adjacent rooms and offered you keyboards to give my machine a Turing test, what might you want to ask it?
I wouldn't believe it to begin with. That would be my response.
Well, but in 20 years from now, whenever.
But I don't think a Turing test is much good by itself. I think you can fool a Turing test. Depends what you ask.
What would you say if I said the other person is a liar? I don't know. Well, one thing would be interesting to find out whether this thing had subjective states.
Yes, but how would you do that?
Well, first, if it's fully intelligent, just by asking it. I mean, clearly, if it's intelligent, it must have... See, I don't know whether intelligence and consciousness go hand in hand. I mean, can you get an intelligent machine? In principle, it seems to me you should be able to get an intelligent machine without consciousness, right?
But it only works one way. Suppose you had a monkey trying to do a Turing test, or a chimp. You couldn't say, well, because the chimp couldn't reply to the thing that it wasn't conscious, could you? You can't say it that way round.
No. No, I mean, clearly this assumes language.
So the argument is, if you could pass an exhaustive Turing test, then you would argue it would be conscious, but you can't say if you...
No, I'm not sure I would, Francis. I would say it's intelligent. Whether it's conscious, I don't know. I mean, consciousness, I think... I mean, can't you imagine, in principle... We know, in principle, how to build an intelligent machine. At least we don't think... Nobody thinks that there's any insurmountable difficulty, right, with building an intelligent machine. I mean, you know, everybody assumes it can be done. It's just a question of tactics and, you know, what algorithm and how... You scale up memory.
But you see, the Turing machine doesn't allow you to test the things like whether the machine could recognize something very quickly.
No, it's a very abstracted version, right? It doesn't talk about learning, which I think has got to be key for any intelligent machine. Clearly, it has to be able to learn, right, in order to survive. And of course, it doesn't deal at all. See, it deals with the aspect of intelligence that people at the time thought important. You know, there's this apocryphal story of Marvin Minsky giving a summer student a job, an undergraduate job, of getting a machine to see. Because clearly, that's simple, right? You get a camera, you feed it in. You know, we know vision is simple. The real problem is playing chess and getting the machine to solve mathematical problems, you know, to get the machine to solve simple geometric problems. Well, it turns out we have, you know, with Deep Blue, we have machines that can solve simple geometric, you know, prove simple geometric proposition. We don't have a machine that can even do what a fly can do routinely, right? And so none of those things are contained in the Turing test. There's no sense of, you know, seeing, of smelling, of hearing, of moving, of motor control, of learning. So all the things that make biological intelligence, you know, so robust, aren't contained in there. It's a very abstracted version, very cerebral version.
If you can't ask the machine, well, look at that scene and describe it to me.
That would impress me.
You see?
You know, what's here?
That would be impressive if they could do that. You know, you say, well, there's a swimming pool and a board and there's this funny thing in the water and the trees and the flowers and describe the various things and this, that and the other and so on. I can see the water moving because of the wind and so on. That's not the Turing test, you see. Turing test is a very limited test. And I agree, I think it's a test for a limited sort of intelligence.
Okay, be that as it may, if it's true that a machine could pass this test, okay, would you assume it's conscious?
If it could do it in real time, I begin to wonder.
But we agree, I think, that this demonstrates intelligence or some sort of linguistic intelligence. But it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with consciousness, or does it?
Well, you can try and do the zombie test. And,
wait, but how do you do that in a linguistic creature? I remember, it doesn't have cameras or anything, it just has a teletype.
No, you have to have something that can see or something. I don't think that's the whole point. The seeing is the difficult part, that's just what you said. You can't see without eyes. So I think the point is the Turing test is a very limited, just repeating what you said. It's a very limited one, and just is supposed to test certain sort of intelligence, but it doesn't test perception. And perception turns out to be the difficult thing. I don't know whether you can put meaning into a Turing machine, can you?
So I think meaning, you need a robot that has sensor and has output effectors. So it needs to, for instance, it needs to be able to realize that if I move this across here, then something predictable is going to happen on my retina. And once it begins to do that and can manipulate things and play with them and make predictions, that's how I think we acquire as children. We acquire meaning of the world. We begin to explore it. We realize that there are things that are proximal, there are things that are distal. And so space begins to get meaning. And so I think without having sensory input and an output to be able to affect the world, I don't think you can get meaning. So I'm not sure you could get, if you're total sessile, like one of those sea anemones, I don't think you can ever have meaning. It seems to me you need some sort of way to affect the output.
Well, at least you must have several sorts of inputs.
But without any output, I don't see, at some point, I mean, maybe I get paralyzed.
Well, obviously, it's easiest to do it if you have some sort of output. But I'm not quite sure whether you can't do it with looking coherence and different inputs.
I see. So you mean you just established different sensory inputs and you say if they're coherence, so you can extract invariances.
Yes, that's what I do think. But I agree with you that if you can interact with it, that's even more powerful.
So the Turing machine, you know, doesn't have any of these notions. It's a typical mathematical device, right? It's very abstract, which means you can do certain calculus on it, right? Which is good. On the other hand, it's so abstract that everything that makes it interesting has been removed from it, you know. It's like saying, well, the world consists of a collection of points, you know. Let's think about that. Well, it's true in some sense, but it doesn't really help you anything about analyzing molecules or, you know, this. It's a collection of points.
You're a Roman Catholic?
Yeah, I was raised Roman Catholic, yeah.
And a reductionist biologist.
Yes.
Do you integrate those?
Well, I think about it quite a bit because I was raised that way. I think about it quite a way, and I haven't really found... I mean, right now, you know, the hypothesis we're pursuing... I'm not sure how far that can be pushed. So right now, we are pursuing the hypothesis that subjective feeling and qualia, I mean, is caused by activity in the brain. There's nothing else. I mean, this is his version of what's called physicalism, and that's sort of not, you can't really reconcile that with classical Roman Catholic faith. And I think eventually I went to this conference organized by the bishop. Yeah, right now I don't see any way to reconcile those two, except in a very weak, intellectually not very satisfying sense, right? You could say, well, you know, here's all the physical world and over here is sort of his God, but they don't really interact in any way, right? Sort of God created all of that, but then sort of it's there and all the physical, you know, laws sort of run its course, but there's just no interaction between them, right? Sort of a very weak form of...
The prime mover.
Yeah, the prime mover, right? Which, of course, you know, you can never, as scientists, you cannot test, right? You know, if it's like that, well, you know, if God sort of, you know, willed the initial... Big Bang, right, and then sort of left the universe alone, fine, but that's sort of very, both intellectually and emotionally, very unsatisfactory state of affairs.
There's definitely no Casper sort of wafting above, and there's nobody tallying the fall of sparrows.
I've forgotten.
It was very funny. At this bishop conference, one of the bishops was in fact deriding the notion. He said, "Well, you know, all my parishioners, they all have this notion that the soul is like Casper." He was using exactly what he said. All my parishioners think, or most of my parishioners think, Casper. You know, their soul is like Casper the Ghost, sort of it trails around. When they die, it goes in some sort of hyperspace, and then at the end of time, it's reunified with their body again. And he was deriding that, although. And this position has changed in the church over the last 2,000 years. But I think many theologians currently view the fact that they're also not dualists. They realize that dualism is not compatible with current scientific thinking. On the other hand, there's still this notion that at the end of time, then you will be reunified with your body.
So if they're not dualists, what are they?
Well, it's sort of, yeah, I couldn't quite understand. It's probably just my lack of background knowledge. But the idea is, right now when I die, then I die, okay, and there's no Casper the Goat that floats around. Yet somehow, at the end of time, the idea is that sort of God in his mercy resurrects you and attaches your mind to your body at some state, and it's unclear, you know, is it your old body, is it your young body?
In a sense, but in a very literal sense.
No, you don't attach the mind to the body.
Yeah, I think in a very literal sense, yeah.
And you look at that book I've got. I've got a book called the... What was the title?
Various Conceptions of Resurrection and...
It's Resurrection of the Body, I think it's called.
Yeah, in the Middle Ages.
As I understand, the early Christians thought the body would be resurrected, so they didn't have any need for the idea of a soul. It was just another part of the behavior of your body.
And soul apparently came from... Soul is a distinctly Platonistic invention, you know, came from Plato, you know, the immortal soul inhabited in this body. And even very early on in Christendom, there were these different camps. Some people said there is no soul, you know, and other people said there is a soul. Today, of course, most, at least sort of in the vernacular, and sort of most Christians, if you just interview them, strongly believe in the idea of a soul. But at least a lot of theologians do not seem to believe in this idea of a soul. So it's, of course, you can't test any of this.
You mentioned a quote of yours that was something about that being something to the effect of being too wired is not really being wired at all. Or we were talking about all the information glut and...
I can't recall that. How you can is it Caltech?
I think it might have been when you were at my studio. I'm not sure. And we were talking about... or I think we were talking on the phone, actually. You were talking about how when you leave the country, you don't do email because you're not where you're going, and that we can be so... bombarded by information that in a sense we don't know anything. We're just too busy responding to the immediate
needs, yes.
So?
There was and you had some great quote on that topic.
Oh, I see. I don't know what I said.
Whatever it was really good.
What can it have been?
Well, to the effect, you know, if you're constantly in touch. Oh, of course! It's a quote that from your autobiography. Busy life is a wasted life.
Oh, yes, that one. Is that it?
That was the one, yeah.
Yes, a busy life is a wasted life, yeah.
Yeah, because I.
Only two people have quoted me that back.
Well, I like it a lot. I constantly
quote
it.
Well, yes. Well, I've got a quote in the Dictionary of Quotations, but they've got my name wrong, so I've got to write to them sometime. So I suggest they put in that quote.
Do you care to expand on that, or is that... self-evident?
No. There's this sentence we wrote in our first paper. It's not escaped our notice, and it's now in a Dictionary of Quotations, you see.
But No. I think Glenn wanted to know where you got the quote, "A busy life is a waste."
Oh, I invented it. It sounds as if it's a quotation, but it's a quotation from me.
You.
Yes.
No, I just...
Yes.
Meaning that that the unexamined life is not worth living, in a sense, perhaps? Is similar.
Well, I just got the impression here that everybody was too busy. You see, and they didn't have time to sort of...
I mean, you see these people constantly on the cell phone, right? The first thing they sit down, they open a cell phone and call somebody, right? The first thing they come, they visit you, says, well, you know, I need to log in, you know. Then they do some trivial email about the administrator, you know, and then, you know, they pay you 5 minutes attention, then they rush off to do something else. And clearly, you know, they're constantly overexposed, you know, it's like ADD, attentional deficit disorder, right? They don't, you know, they don't really do anything except they, you know, all these low level, you know, serving all those low level needs, you know, they totally forget sort of the big picture. I really feel sorry for these
people. There is an essay of Russell's called, maybe even a book, In Praise of Idleness, which I remember reading when I was a young man. So well, that's
I mean, this is entire philosophy. I just got a book called Leisure, a German philosopher in 1950, on the theory on how important it is to have leisure time. But that, I think, more in the direction of the unexamined life.
You've been listening to Strange Angels on KBeach Radio. We've joined The Quest for Consciousness today with neurobiologists Francis Crick and Christoph Koch. Thanks to Francis and Christoph for visiting with us, and thanks to audio engineer Richard Cooper for his fantastic post-production work on the recording. You'll find links to Francis' former home, the Salk Institute, and Christoph's website at Caltech, both on the Strange Angels website, www.artboy.info/strange. Be sure to sign up for the Strange podcast while you're there. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.